Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field.
The precipitating event was that the farmers wanted a state-owned mill. They gave approval, authorized it essentially, and then the legislature said that they wouldn't do it. And so suddenly there was that situation where the political parties were unresponsive even after the people of North Dakota had asked them to do something. And 2 months later, two people who had been members of the Socialist Party organized the Nonpartisan League. And a year later, they took over the state.
And that's how it's done. Get the people to insist on something they want and then make the politicians deliver or leave. Hi, this is Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, welcoming you once again to another edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Today we're going to take another look at how the people of North Dakota managed to take on the powers that be 100 years ago to build a legacy of local empowerment and protection of self-interest over and against the large corporate and monopolistic powers of their day and ours. Our guest is David Morris, co-founder of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, who tells some wonderful stories about how the example of those plains farmers back in the day sets an example for us today as we struggle against the same forces that are eating away at our commonwealth and our public interest. Let's begin with our discussion with David Morris of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, which focuses on the primacy of local interests and action.
One of the things about working at the local level, as they say, the local level is where the rubber meets the road, and what is both challenging and enlightening is how one, in fact, makes something happen. I mean, how does one convince them to do something? And, you know, in some ways, unlike the federal level, at the local level, you have scarce resources, and the biggest scarce resource is people. And so you not only have to get someone's attention, but you have to get someone to do something that they're not already doing, which means usually not doing something that they are already doing. And one way to do that is to do the work for them in terms of the research. But then there's the work of sort of lobbying internal to the bureaucracy and the agencies. And so, you know, that tends to be very challenging, especially at the local level. The state level is a little less challenging. I mean, one has to convince them, but they do have those kinds of resources.
Well, you wrote a really interesting piece called How to Make a Political Revolution, and it was based on the story of the Bank of North Dakota, which we talk about pretty regularly. Great stories associated with how these local people took on big powers. Tell us a little bit about, in your view, what were the dynamics that really helped to bring that political revolution about and how it looks today?
Sure. Well, one should recall that this is North Dakota we're talking about in the early 20th century. And it was a state that then had about 600,000 people. It only has maybe 750,000 people now. So if one wants to think about it in terms of the number of people either in your city or in your metropolitan area, or if you live in Vermont or some other small states, the number of people in your state. And essentially what was happening in the late 19th century and early 20th century in the Midwest, in the upper Midwest, was a deep dissatisfaction by farmers about their plight. And in the case of North Dakota, you were talking about a state that was essentially a colony of Minneapolis. Their railroads were owned by a person who lived in St. Paul, and the grain was milled in Minneapolis mills. The grain elevators are owned by Minneapolis grain companies, and the banks were Minneapolis banks that loaned into North Dakota. And so it was a very clear case. One did not have to convince anybody of that situation. And in the late 19th century, you had the populist movement, you had the cooperative movement, and they created new institutional forms in mutual aid and mutual self-help. But what they realized was that they were struggling upstream. They were trying to swim upstream against rules and institutions that had been created that were larger than they. And so they needed to deal with political power. And in the early part of the 20th century, there were two things that happened. One was that they got the direct primary, and that was a progressive revolution and a progressive movement that essentially introduced primaries as a way to bypass the political conventions and the political bosses' domination of politics. And the other thing that they got was a referendum and initiative, and so that people could essentially on their own create laws. And what happened was that the precipitating event was that the farmers wanted a state-owned mill elevator. It's called the terminal elevator, which was an elevator for storage and a mill for processing. And they wanted that, and they had a referendum in which they gave approval, authorized it essentially. And then the legislature in January of 2015 said that they wouldn't do it. And so suddenly there was that situation where the political parties were unresponsive even after the people of North Dakota had asked them to do something. And 2 months later, in March of 2015, two people who had been members of the Socialist Party and had run on the Socialist Party ticket organized the Nonpartisan League. And a year later, they took over the state. And the reason that they could do that, several reasons actually, but one was that they had what was called an open primary. There are open primaries and closed primaries. And in a closed primary, when you go and vote in the Democratic or the Republican primary, you have to be a member of the Democratic and Republican Party. But in an open primary, you do not have to be. And so what that meant is that they could, in March of 2016, they...
Let me just interrupt you. But you mean 1915, right?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Every 100 years, I'm going to make that mistake. Yes, indeed. And so they would have an endorsing convention, and they could endorse Democrats, they could endorse, you know, Republicans, and they did. But the Republican Party was dominant in North Dakota at that time, as they are now. And so they essentially ran their candidates in the Republican primary. And in June of 1916 was the Republican primary, and they essentially took over the Republican Party. And then that November they had elections, and they took over, mostly took over the state of Minnesota.
You mean North Dakota?
They took over the government, and then in 1918 they took over the complete government, every aspect of the government. So one factor in their success was that they had this ability to run independent candidates in party primaries. And the second thing is that they were incredible organizers. The key to organizing in 1915 was a car. And they got a car. They had very little money, but they got a car, and they got to put some gas in the car. You got to understand, 1915, there weren't a whole bunch of gas stations. And that allowed them to get around the state. And they gave speeches just about every day in the state. And they asked for a membership fee. Now, the membership fee that they asked for in 1915 was, in 1916, was $8, well, it was $6, and then it was $8 a year. Now, $6 and $8 a year, the typical farm income at that time was about $400 a year. Hmm. So about 2% of their income they were asking for as a membership fee. And that's a substantial amount of money. And in fact, they made it a substantial amount of money because they said if farmers treated this as an investment, they would stick to it, as opposed to a sort of a trivial fee so that they could be a member of a party. And the third thing that was important was that they had a very clear platform. They did not run on trite phrases. They did not run on social justice and fairness for all. They ran on a platform that contained half a dozen planks, and they were very specific: a bank of North Dakota, a mill in North Dakota, a elevator in North Dakota, insurance company in North Dakota. And so that's what they ran on. And when they were elected, that was in fact the platform that they implemented. So those three things, I think, are very important for us to know now, you know, 100 years later. And they came to power. They were only in power for 5 years. So people need to know it was a very brief moment, 1916 to 1921, essentially. But in those 5 years, they initially had a referendum in which the people of North Dakota said that their state could become involved in businesses. That was a key constitutional change for the state. They said the state could borrow money. That was a key constitutional change. They said that the state could set up a bank. And since they were government, they immediately did, in fact, set up that bank. They did set up the elevator and the flour mill. And then they broadened the ability of citizens to make their own legislation. I said that they had referendum and initiative previously, but they expanded it. They made it easier for people to get issues on the ballot, and they added recall. And they were the first state to have recall, which meant essentially that people could recall their elected politicians. And it proved in some ways their Achilles heel. It was democracy sort of gone too far, because the opposition, in the process of taking over, they recalled the entire slate, senior slate, if you will, of the Nonpartisan League. And so the opposition came to power in 1921 and immediately put on the ballot new constitutional amendments that would abolish the Bank of North Dakota, that would cut dramatically the amount of borrowing power of the state and so forth. And they had, I believe it was either 8 or 9 ballot initiatives that the legislature put on the ballot, and every one of them was defeated, although very, very narrowly, but they were all defeated. And so in essence, you had a situation where the people were, for a whole bunch of reasons, sort of upset, if you will, with the Nonpartisan League, but at the same time they honored the laws that they had passed and they wanted the institutions that they had created. And so 1916 to 1921, a period of astonishing activity, and then they were thrown out of power, but the institutions that they created continued, and the thinking that in fact people could collectively make rules and create institutions that would allow them independence was one that continues to this day. And one of the, I think, important aspects of the Nonpartisan League, it was a, they sometimes use the term proprietor capitalism. It was capitalism for the little people. It was not socialism in the sense that the state did not own the means of production, but the state did have a public option. That's what we would call it, I think, in 2016, is that you had a Bank of North Dakota, but you had other banks as well. You had a state, a flour mill and an elevator, but you also had private flour mills and elevators. So essentially, the state kept the private sector honest, and it gave people a choice. And that was, you know, essentially what the Nonpartisan League was about. This isn't just something that happened 100 years ago and that was that, because in 1932, the citizens of North Dakota decided to ban corporate ownership of farmland. Mm-hmm. And in June of 2016, the citizens overwhelmingly rejected a ballot initiative by the big corporations that would have overturned that 1932 law. In 1963, they passed a law, once again, by referendum and initiative, that essentially banned chain ownership of drugstores. If you own a pharmacy, if you operate a pharmacy in the state of North Dakota, it has to be owned by a state-licensed pharmacist. And so essentially, they do have some chain pharmacies, but those were the ones that were grandfathered in that existed in 1963, but otherwise they do not. And in 2014, and I say that 2014, the citizens overwhelmingly rejected a Walmart and Walgreens financed, handsomely financed, initiative that would have repealed the pharmacy ownership law. But essentially, what happens is that when you have these institutions that are rooted, and when people suddenly realize that these things are working for them, that later on it becomes difficult for entrenched interests, if you will, and the wealthy and the large corporations to undo them. My organization, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, has been involved with a number of battles, if you will, helping the people of North Dakota, and one of them was against the effort to overturn the pharmacy ownership law. And so we worked with the Independent Pharmacy Association in North Dakota, and we provided a basic report that was very helpful in the legislative process, and went there to testify at the legislature. And in the testimony in the legislature by the independent pharmacists, they essentially laid bare their accounting system, and they showed what is the price that they charge for their drugs versus what Walgreens charged for their drugs, and they were lower. And the quality of their services was much higher. The customer satisfaction was enormous. The number of pharmacies in rural areas in North Dakota was dramatically higher than the number of pharmacies in South Dakota, which is a good comparison state. So I think that there's many lessons that we can learn from the Nonpartisan League and not think that it was something, it was an artifact of a certain age and couldn't be done again.
Yeah, a terrifically interesting story and so relevant for today's realities. You quote an observer who would describe them as a large, loose, animated, and untidy, but sure of itself in its settled disallowance of the vested interests. And it sounds like that has been going on for better part of 100 years.
Yes, but I think it's important to point out that by 1918, and some would say by late 1916, so the figures are not perfectly accurate, they had 40,000 members.
Wow.
They had 40,000 members. Now, this is a state that had only a little over 600,000 in their population. So, you know, that's astounding. One could argue that I think it might have been 60% of all the, or 70% of all the farm households. And they were paying 2% of their income into this. And they did so because they said to themselves, look, I'm a farmer. As a farmer, I know how much more I would get if, in fact, I didn't have to send it to Minneapolis and therefore subtract the transportation cost from the price that I'm getting. And that I know how much I produce and so forth. And so the membership fee was, in fact, an investment where they could calculate what their return would be if they won. And therefore, they wanted to win, and they talked to their neighbors about it. And I think that in 2016, we tend to, in some ways, allow people to identify with movements without some investment, and we promise them things that are relatively general. Now, that's not uniformly the case, of course. The $15 per hour minimum wage movement has been very concrete and very focused. But I think that when we talk about the political platforms that we might propose, they do tend to be somewhat more amorphous.
Very impressive to see that these people used the local institutions to leverage their freedom and choices in years to come, as opposed to giving up to the market interests that are at play everywhere. The banking industry there, of course, is the same way, isn't it? In North Dakota, there's nowhere else in the country where community banks are thriving the way they are there.
That's exactly right, and I think that, once again, it's important that there was a debate about whether the Bank of North Dakota would be a retail bank. There was a debate about that. And they decided that it would not be, that it would be a wholesale bank, and that, in fact, it would be a bank to enable community banks, but not a bank that would supersede community banks. And you're right at this day. I mean, if you look at North Dakota in terms of, as I mentioned, the independent pharmacies that it has, but if you look at North Dakota in terms of the number of community banks it has and the prosperity of community banks that it has. And I think that some people who are of a certain age right now, meaning young people, might say, well, in North Dakota, they've had that oil boom. Yes, they have, but we're talking about statistics that are valid before the oil boom.
Now, you're the director of the Public Good Initiative at the Institute. Would you tell us a little bit about what that embodies?
Right. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance has, since our inception, which was in 1974, has been focused on the issue of scale and ownership, and specifically focused on what cities can do in terms of exercising the authority that they have to enable their citizens to have a ownership stake in their future and to generate a significant amount of their wealth, not entirely internal to their borders. We think of cities as nations, not autarkic, but self-conscious. You know, nations are, except for North Korea, are not autarkic. They're not self-sufficient, but they do map the flow of resources through their borders, and they do enact laws that essentially try to maximize the good and the welfare of the people within their borders, and that's similar to the way we approach cities. We started an initiative about 3 or 4 years ago that is called the Public Good Initiative, which is somewhat broader. It deals also with the issue of scale, but it primarily focuses on the issue of the public and the private. The founding fathers, when they set up the Constitution and declared independence of Great Britain, they thought, John Adams talked about the positive passion for the public good should always supersede the private interests. And we have a rich history in this country of doing that. I mean, the first major public institution in the United States of America is in the Constitution, was part of the cabinet for 200 years, and it's called the Post Office. And the post office has a rich history, not only in delivering the mail. I mean, delivering the mail is certainly something that the post office does. But at its very inception, in 1792, Congress enacted subsidies such that the newspapers would be delivered free from city to city. And they did that because they wanted information to be broadly disseminated, and they wanted to have an informed citizen, and it worked out astonishingly well. In fact, Alex de Tocqueville, a Frenchman who is well known in American history as someone who traveled in the early part of the 19th century throughout America and took excellent notes on what the culture and what the people were like. And he said that it was an astounding thing for a Frenchman to see that in every small town in the United States at that time, there was a newspaper and people were informed of the news. And in the late 19th century, when the package delivery, parcel delivery firms were becoming an oligopoly and they were mistreating their consumers, the post office started a parcel post. And in the early 20th century, when the banks were mistreating their customers, they started the postal banking system. So this was an institution that was a public institution that saw itself broadly as trying to honor and maximize the public good. We created the national parks. We created a decentralized, publicly owned system of libraries. We created a decentralized, publicly owned system of public education. And then in the 1930s, we, of course, expanded the concept of the public good to social insurance, like Social Security, and in the 1960s to health care, at least for the elderly. And so we have a rich tradition, but in the last 30 years, and I mean literally from 1980 on, we have begun to subordinate the public to the private. And in 2016, the word government is now a pejorative. The word public is not that far behind. And the word private is sacred. And so, you know, people now see privatization in virtually every aspect of American life, and it in fact has sort of colonized even our thinking. So people now think that government enterprises are inherently less efficient than private enterprises, and they see the government as being unresponsive and so on and so forth. Yeah. And so in 2013, we created this initiative to specifically address the issue of the public and the private, and to try to reclaim the narrative and trying to inform people that although everybody likes to complain about the government, it turns out that public institutions, whether it's a municipally owned utility company or a municipally owned water department, that it turns out that government can and does provide competitive and high quality services and has traditionally done that.
What would you say the key steps would be for citizens to restore and reverse this trend against public ownership in the commons?
Well, I think one thing that they can do is they can talk about it. Even among one's friends, if you talk about government or you talk about public enterprise, the immediate, you know, reaction will be, well, that doesn't work, or they can't do that, or that's corrupt, or that's inefficient, or you have, you know, civil servants who are lazy or overpaid, or I mean, you will get that immediate reaction, and one needs to engage in that conversation. And if you engage in that conversation, you need to be informed. And there is a rich literature that will give you chapter and verse on the efficiencies of the public sector. But we're not only talking about public ownership, although that's an important part of it, but we're also talking about the public option in the same way that the Nonpartisan League was talking about the public option. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance works with cities to encourage them, enable them, and help them to build their own telecommunications network, high-speed fiber-based telecommunications networks. And there are about 80 cities now in the country that have citywide fiber networks, and many, many more have partial fiber networks to their schools or internal to the operations of cities. And in virtually every one of those cities, there are phone companies and cable companies that provide internet service and broadband service. And so it's a competitive environment. It's not a monopoly by the city, but every time that they establish one of those, the rates mysteriously go down precipitously. and so, you know, even if they ran at a loss, if you take into account the savings that people get from their cable bills or their phone bills, it way offsets, you know, any subsidy that might come from the taxpayers. And most of these don't have any subsidy whatsoever from the taxpayers. So I think that the public option is important. And then the other is the exercise of authority over the private sector. I mean, we have gotten to this to the point right now where you have political parties that essentially are asking for the abolition of public authority. So I think that, I mean, there are a number of steps to be done, but it seems to me that the very first step is to reclaim the narrative, and the way to do that is for people to open their mouths and initially say, geez, I've been bombarded by my friends and I can't answer to their questions, and then to do a little research and open your mouths again.
Well, David, this has been very good. I want to thank you and the Institute for Local Self-Reliance for setting the stage to make this a receptive environment. The public banking initiative is building directly on the kind of work that you guys have done. So thanks very much for that, David.
Thank you very much for interviewing me, Walt. I appreciate the work that you've done. It's been foundational.
That's David Morris, co-founder of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance.